Disc 2. In his mad quest for vengeance, Ahab usurps the Pequod from its owners to serve his own monomaniacal lust for revenge, which results in the death of his crew of 30 men and leaves his wife widowed and son fatherless. He is basically a twisted psychopath, driven to starkest madness by the pain and humiliation of losing a leg to the white whale. He betrays everyone who trusts him and depends on him and sends 30 men to their deaths to fulfill his mad obsession against a fish. In short, a pretty messed up dude. Or so he has been reckoned for these last 150 years, anyway. I read a few reviews and introductions before starting the book and found that the one thing everyone seemed to have in common regarding Moby Dick was that they found it ambiguous, not open to definitive interpretation. After the first of my two epiphanies, I would investigate much more deeply. I would look through all the books in Mary's library, search the internet on the laptop in Bill's office, and even make a trip into the city for 2 days to do research in some libraries there, including, through no conscious intent, the Epiphany branch of the New York Public Library in Gramercy Park. What I finally concluded was that no one had ever formed a clear picture about this book. The general consensus seemed to be that no clear picture was even possible. Many reviewers would try to make sense of it by saying that the ocean represents this, and the whale represents that, and Ahab's quest represents the other thing, but never in ways that made much sense, as the authors of these theories would often admit. Does Moby Dick represent man's battle against nature, against fate, against God? Is Ahab a Prometheus, a Job, a Narcissus? Is he a tragic hero? Is Moby Dick about good versus evil? Evil versus evil? Evil versus eviler? Whack job versus fish? Is it an exploration of the human psyche? Is it political allegory? An anti-slavery manifesto? An indictment of capitalism and industrialization? A pro-democracy treatise? None of the above? What then? Let's keep it simple. What does it mean when a guy is so freakishly twisted that he would destroy everyone and everything just to take revenge on a stupid fish? What do we make of that? What can we make of it? Is it any wonder no one has come up with a clear explanation? Is any clear explanation even possible? Or was Melville, as critics have effectively concluded, vague and unclear in his own mind as to what he was writing about? The answer, as we'll see, is no. Melville knew exactly what he was doing when he wrote Moby Dick. There's nothing vague or unclear about it, and, as we'll also see, there's a very simple reason why no one has truly understood it before now. All well and good, but the real question that concerns us here is this: is Moby Dick, understood correctly, of any possible interest to readers of a book called Spiritually Incorrect Enlightenment? I'll answer that, for now, by saying this. Herman Melville was among the foremost spiritual pioneers of his race, and the book Moby Dick is the captain's log of the journey he took. So yes, it's of some possible interest. Chapter 5. Spiritual Autolysis. Nothing goes by luck in composition. It allows of no tricks. The best you can write will be the best you are. Henry David Thoreau. In Damnedest, I introduced the process of spiritual autolysis, which is really nothing more than a kind of journaling on steroids designed to help us burn through the seemingly endless layers of ego and delusion in the quickest and least painful manner. Try to write something true, and keep at it until you do. That's the match that becomes the blaze. Also in Damdus, we met Julie, a bright and attractive young woman who had come to see me for the ostensible purpose of interviewing me for a holistic magazine. What she left with was a bit more than she came for, at least more than she thought she came for. What actually transpired was that Julie took the one step she had been moving toward her entire life, and perhaps lifetimes before that, the first step. We ended Damnedest on that note, pointing out that, for Julie, nothing was over, but only just beginning. What it was the beginning of, we are able to hold up for display here because Julie chose to use the process of spiritual autolysis as her primary method for waging the long battle she found herself facing. She also chose to use me as the target recipient for her writings, which makes very good sense. It allows her to write to someone she knows, to envision someone sitting across from her as she writes, or pacing with her as she paces, or accompanying her on long, thoughtful walks. I am someone she knows, and I am a graduate of the process she is undergoing. It is a very powerful tool for her to be able to address herself to an imagined me. When I was in this same process, I didn't have someone like me to address myself to, so I addressed myself to you, my imagined reader. From my perspective, spiritual enlightenment, the damnedest thing, had around 15 predecessors written over the course of 2 years, more than a dozen years before I started Damnedest, each one of them written with the sincere intention that it should go to print, each one ending up burned or erased, and each one having served its real purpose. Early in my stay at Mary's house, I met her housekeeper's son. Curtis is an 18-year-old black kid who was picking his mother up one day and bitching about having to get a job flipping burgers until September, when he starts at a community college where he has a partial soccer scholarship lined up. We talked for a few minutes, and I asked if he wanted to work for me instead of McDonald's. I always have a bunch of stuff to do that I don't want to do, especially with regard to writing and researching a second book. He said okay, so we asked his mom if it was okay. She figured I must be okay if I was Mary's guest, so she said okay. Okay. One of the things Curtis has to do is go through my huge backlog of email and make one of three decisions about each item. Trash it if possible, file it if necessary, or show it to me if he can't possibly manage not to. This isn't easy for him because he starts out completely unfamiliar with spiritual stuff in general and my views in particular. Still, he gives it an honest effort. He reads Damnedest on the laptop, asks some good questions, and develops a feel for the way I work. He stays aloof, doesn't accept or reject anything, but he understands what I need and works sufficiently and cheerfully. Over the course of the first week, we get the hang of each other and start to develop a casual rapport. As he is sorting through my email, Curtis comes upon the subdirectory where I route Julie's emails to me, often unread. I looked through the first dozen or so to see if I was needed for anything, but I wasn't. There's more than a year's worth of email, and sometimes she sent as many as 10 a day. One of the things I asked Curtis to do is go through it and see what's there. He comes to me with a thick stack of Julie's emails that he's printed out, wondering what should be done with them. Julie was born for this process of awakening, and she's shooting along as fast as anyone possibly could. I told her to put the word Beatrice in the subject header if she wanted my attention or response, but she hasn't done it yet. She sometimes goes from light and chatty to intense and scary in the space of a single paragraph. That's a good sign because it means she's not rereading and editing herself too much. That's the way to do it. Just keep plowing ahead. Don't waste a moment on appearances. What's behind you is behind you. She addresses her understanding of the importance of this ceaseless forward motion here.
This process of spiritual autolysis is somewhat difficult on me for a silly reason. As a professional writer, and as a student aspiring to be a professional writer before that, I have always relied on the process of editing and rewriting to get my words the way I want them. I am absolutely loath to simply write words and move on, leaving them in rough draft form. I see the value of it. I see how it works. I know no one is going to see them except maybe you, Jed. Probably not, but I have to proceed as if you're hanging on every word. I guess the thing I am writing and rewriting and editing and re-editing is the underlying thoughts, more than merely the words. So the process of constant refinement has simply moved to a different level. Still, I'm not accustomed to writing once and leave the words unpolished.
Discovering and creating the process is part of the process, meaning that you have to build your own process and be your own mechanic. Fine-tune it to your needs and preferences, repair it on the fly, jettison whatever is unnecessary as it becomes unnecessary.
I've known 40 or 50 supposedly enlightened men and women. I've interviewed them, I've read their books, I've listened to their words, I've attended more satsangs than I can remember. The magazines I wrote for opened doors, and I always cast my subjects in the most flattering light. So I was always welcome. I search my memories now, and I can't think of one of those exalted personages that was anything, more or less, than a specialized, minimized, hybridized, accessorized, or otherwise modified ego. Exalted egos. It seems so sad and pitiful now, looking back on it, silly little men and women expounding their customized variations on safe, proven themes like unity, meditation, consciousness, living in the present, love, service, higher consciousness, and so forth, looking down on all the upturned faces of people so eagerly seeking not truth, but merely someone they could look up to. The blind leading the blind. Just children, really. That was me. You called them the final level of containment, and that's really what they are. Not shepherds of freedom, but guardians of delusion. I am starting to see why that is, and why it's not bad, but I'm not there yet. I'm still angry and resentful. I shouldn't be, but I am, or I am, so I guess I should be. I know they're not evil or committing any crime, that they're just functionaries performing in the service of Maya. And it's not that I'm angry at them, but at myself for believing them, for being such a sheep, and for casting them in the most flattering light.
Julie is originally from Canada, and her family has a cabin, or a lodge, or something that they use as a vacation getaway. That's where she is as she's writing this. She has the place to herself, except for the occasional bear going through her garbage. She's working on a Macintosh PowerBook, and I bet she types around 120 words a minute when she gets going. That's how it feels to me sometimes when I'm reading them, like her fingers couldn't get the words out fast enough.
I look back on all that now as the height, or should I say depth, of folly. If one of those much-vaunted spiritual teachers showed up on my front porch right now offering to help me work through this thing I'm in, I wouldn't let them in. Wouldn't even open the door. Why would I? They're of no possible use to me now. They have no familiarity whatsoever with this process, no acquaintance with the transformation from self to no self. Better I should let in a hungry bear. The modern spiritual teacher could offer no more guidance to someone being consumed by the process of awakening than could the local fishing guide. I'm already starting to appreciate the profound importance of the word further. Part of me wants to stay and dwell on the fascinating workings of false teachings, gullibility, self-delusion, fear, ego, denial, the whole lot. The psychology of spiritual individuals and groups, especially in the teacher-student relationship, seems like a perfect topic for an article or a book, and I feel drawn to spend more time with it. But then I picture you, Jed, sitting here across from me, and you don't even have to speak. I see my desire to find a distraction for what it is. I have to remember that I'm not here as a journalist or a sightseer. I'm on my own journey, just passing through, and there are always temptations and rationalizations that would take me from the journey. That's why the most important word is further. I understand that. One must be ever vigilant, because the enemy is. Everything about the world and about ourselves demands that we stop, and we have only that one thing to hold up against all those powerful temptations, the word further. Here's where I find my own supposed goodness to be a most malicious adversary. It would be so easy to fall sway to my altruistic impulses, to justify stopping in the name of aiding others, of sharing what I've learned so far, some egoistic bodhisattva bullshit. It's there, now, the feeling that I have achieved an understanding that I must share, which, of course, would demand that I stop to develop my understanding and learn how best to share it, which, of course, amounts to nothing more than stopping. Yes, I want to share what I've learned. Yes, I want to help others, to show them the way. Yes, I want to oppose the darkness and ignorance that I myself have now begun to find my way out of. And yes, that's all an elaborate and painfully effective ploy by ego to get me to cease my journey. Journey being just a metaphor for the process of ripping away the layers of ego, like peeling off my own skin. Am I ranting now? Again? Sorry, these understandings come in bursts and demand immediate expression, or attempts at expression, anyway. You should see all the stuff you're not seeing.
As we'll see, she's not always so sane and thoughtful. It's very helpful to have a metaphor within which to conduct the process. This provides a familiar framework within which to navigate, identify features, monitor progress, and so forth. Reformatting the cluttered hard drive of ego, or waging a battle on the armies of delusion, are examples. The point is to create a mental space, a 3D construct like a virtual reality within which to conduct your journey, like generals supervising a war while standing over a map table. I gave her a few suggestions about how to provide a contextual framework for her process, and she adopted the idea that exploring and cleaning her own interior space was not so very different from venturing into an attic that has been used indiscriminately for storage for many years.
Where did all this shit come from? What a mess! I thought my mind was mine. But I come up here and find nothing but a dark, dank space stuffed to the rafters with every conceivable manner of garbage and junk. Some of it I recognize, some I don't. This is my mind. This is me. This is who I am. And I expect to find a clean, simple, organized, uncluttered, zen-like space. Instead, I find this horrible, terrible, disgusting mess. It's a miracle I've been able to function. I wish I had a flamethrower or a bomb. I wouldn't even care if it killed me. This is not an analogy. This is my mind, myself, and I am sickened and so fucking outraged, I feel like my head is going to explode.
I laugh. Curtis seems a little perplexed. I look up at him over the teacherish half-moon glasses perched on the end of my nose. What? I ask him. She seems pretty upset, he replies. It's okay, I tell him. It's the best kind of upset. It's all good. Look through it and print what you think is interesting, and we'll look at it for the book. Me? Yeah. Why me? Why not you? How do I know what's interesting? Because it interests you. He stares at me blankly for a moment and turns to go back to the office where the laptop is. I return to the email I'm holding. Julie's only just started the process of venturing into her attic in this one, and her shock at what she's discovering there is quickly turning into outrage and emotional intensity that will aid her greatly in what lies ahead.
I feel like I'm burning in negative emotions, which I've always been taught not to do, but it feels good, necessary. I feel contempt and scorn, even hatred. Everything that's a lie, everyone who perpetrates the lies, everything about me that is a lie, I'm burning with anger. I bury my face in my pillow and just scream. I look around this attic, me, I feel like I was kidnapped as a baby, and only now am I starting to understand the true nature of my captivity, that my entire identity is a fabrication, that my entire world is some sort of hallucination. Who am I? That's all it really is. Who the fuck am I? I look around at all this junk, and I don't know how it got here. It's not me. I didn't put it here. I mean, some of it I did. Some of it I recognize. I see my ballet slippers, guitar, diaries. I see my books and journals. I see the pictures of me, but I know that they're my exaggerated self-images, not what everyone else really sees, and certainly not what's really me. But what is really me? The attic analogy is perfect. I get it. But my attic is dark. I have to find a window and let some sunlight in. Light! More light! Somehow I think it's all about light. Light and lightness, not darkness and heaviness. Somehow I don't think there's much up here, good or bad, that would survive direct illumination. Illumination! That's the key to sorting out this mess. I know I'm babbling like a lunatic, but I don't care. Whatever this is, I want to rip it open and find out what's real. None of this is real. I want to get to something real.
Most spiritually oriented people would probably not even recognize what she's going through as being a part of the awakening process. Most people, spiritual or not, would chew off their own arm to avoid going where this woman is going. This woman is going to have to chew off her own head. But first, she has to go through the process of becoming someone who would prefer chewing off her own head to the alternative. She goes on in this vein for a few dozen paragraphs. Angry, embarrassed, apologetic, betrayed, angrier.
How many years have I spent lighting incense and candles, meditating, chasing after gurus and teachers, reading all that crap, following every stupid new fad, reading every stupid new book? But now I see clearly, perfectly clearly, that all I was ever doing, all it was all about, was avoiding this, avoiding me. I see it now. There's only this. This. All I was doing was keeping myself distracted so I didn't have to do this one thing. Life, the world, reality, all depend on not doing this. This is the one true blasphemy. This is the one true heresy.
I'm pleased. My whole life seems to be about this one small motion, this inward turning. I scan the pages I'm holding and read bits here and there.
There is no outside authority. I am my own authority. What a liberating realization. How could I not have known? There's a huge, monstrous piece of furniture or a crate. I can't even see how large it is. It seems to be Christianity or religion, but not. Nothing is labeled up here. Nothing is clear or specific. It's something heavy and dark and vague, but it's more than that and different, and it's so big. I'll never be able to budget, and that's just one thing. The place is full of things like that. Junk. Mountains of junk. There's a huge thing like black marble, like an insurance company or a bank, or all huge, invasive, greedy financial institutions as they exist in my mind. My heart. Like an immovable mass of dread. Sheer dread. I see a big box, like a coffin with a flag on it. It's like my patriotism. Or maybe my politics, or my national identity, or something. Everything is dark and vague and heavy. I can't make anything out for what it really is. Or maybe none of it is really anything. Maybe that's the whole point. It seems obvious what it is, but now that I look at it, I have no real idea what it is, or why it's here, or how it got here. That's what it's like with all this rubbish. Nothing is what it is. Am I really in here somewhere? Is something in here me? I must find a window. I have to let in some light. But the windows are blocked by debris and I can't even get to them. Light! This place is stifling. I am choking on thick, dead air. On me. I'm choking on the dead air of me. The fact that this is how everyone is, that this is what it is to be a person, that no one's any better off than I am, means absolutely nothing. It's no consolation. I am nothing. I am clutter. I am debris. Garbage. Crammed to the rafters. Nothing seems better or worse than anything else, just bigger or smaller, heavier or lighter. There's Mom and Dad. There's my childhood. There's my god-awful teens. What's all this shit still doing here? Blocking the sun, that's what. Blocking, obstructing, causing putrefaction and dankness and decay. Causing me to be a closed, dark, fearful person behind a cheerful mask. This is oppressing. This is oppressive. This is impossible. I can work at this for 10 lifetimes and never get it clean. It's too much. But what else do I have to do? I have no other business than this. If it takes 10 lifetimes, it takes 10 lifetimes.
It doesn't take 10 lifetimes. But it is a slow and profoundly intimidating process. You do what you can, when you can, one piece at a time. That's within the context of the metaphor. What she's really doing is dismantling a massive ganglion of self that she actually had very little to do with creating. And what she's really, really doing is killing herself, one piece at a time. Chapter 6. No Oasis Situated Yonder. The words of U.G. Krishnamurti, Part 1. The end of illusion is the end of you. U.G. Krishnamurti. There's a lot I really like about U.G. Krishnamurti, and there are times when I don't know what the hell he's talking about. The excerpts provided below, and in two later chapters, represent the overlap between his views and mine. I may have taken some of it a little out of context, but the point here is to try to convey tricky and often paradoxical ideas, as well as to hold up the state of the realized being for observation. And I think these selections do that. For the sincere seeker, to be challenged is to be entertained. They are two sides of the same coin. And whatever else he may be, U.G. Krishnamurti is challenging and entertaining. People call me an enlightened man. I detest that term. They can't find any other word to describe the way I am functioning. At the same time, I point out that there is no such thing as enlightenment at all. I say that because all my life I've searched and wanted to be an enlightened man. And I discovered that there is no such thing as enlightenment at all. And so the question whether a particular person is enlightened or not doesn't arise. I don't give a hoot for 6th century B.C. Buddha, let alone all the other claimants we have in our midst. They are a bunch of exploiters thriving on the gullibility of the people. There is no power outside of man. Man has created God out of fear. So the problem is fear and not God. I discovered for myself and by myself that there is no self to realize. That's the realization I am talking about. It comes as a shattering blow. It hits you like a thunderbolt. You have invested everything in one basket, self-realization, and in the end, suddenly you discover that there is no self to discover, no self to realize. And you say to yourself, "What the hell have I been doing all my life?" That blasts you. We don't want to be free from fear. All that we want to do is to play games with it and talk about freeing ourselves from fear. Your constant utilization of thought to give continuity to your separate self is you. There is nothing there inside you other than that. You see, the search takes you away from yourself. It is in the opposite direction. It has absolutely no relation. The search is always in the wrong direction. So all that you consider very profound, all that you consider sacred, is a contamination in that consciousness. You may not like the word contamination, but all that you consider sacred, holy, and profound is a contamination. My life story goes up to a point, and then it stops. There is no more biography after that. Desirelessness, non-greed, non-anger, those things have no meaning to me. They are false. And they are not only false, they are falsifying me. I'm finished with the whole business. The holy men are all phonies. They are telling me only what is there in the books. That I can read. Do the same again and again. That I don't want. Experiences I don't want. They are trying to share an experience with me. I am not interested in experience. As far as experience goes, for me, there is no difference between the religious experience and the sex experience or any other experience. The religious experience is like any other experience. I am not interested in experiencing Brahman. I am not interested in experiencing reality. I am not interested in experiencing truth. They might help others, but they cannot help me. I am not interested in doing more of the same. What I have done is enough. Who am I to give it to you? You have what I have. We are all at 25 Sanity Street. And you are asking me, where is 25 Sanity Street? I say, you are there. Not that I know I am there. The abstractions that you are throwing at me, I am not interested in. Is there anything behind the abstractions? I had arrived at a point where I said to myself, Buddha deluded himself and deluded others. All those teachers and saviors of mankind were damned fools. They fooled themselves. So I'm not interested in this kind of thing anymore. So it went out of my system completely. I am not trying to sell anything here. It is impossible for you to simulate this. This is a thing that has happened outside the field, the area in which I expected, dreamed, and wanted change. So I don't call this a change. I really don't know what has happened to me. What I am telling you is the way I am functioning. There seems to be some difference between the way you are functioning and the way I am functioning. But basically, there can't be any difference. How can there be any difference between you and me? There can't be. But from the way we are trying to express ourselves, there seems to be. I have the feeling that there is some difference, and what that difference is all that I am trying to understand. So this is the way I am functioning. You see, my difficulty with the people who come to see me is this. They don't seem to be able to understand the way I am functioning, and I don't seem to be able to understand the way they are functioning. How can we carry on a dialogue? Both of us have to stop. How can there be a dialogue between us both? Your natural state has no relationship whatsoever with the religious states of bliss, beatitude, and ecstasy. They lie within the field of experience. Those who have led man on his search for religiousness throughout the centuries have perhaps experienced those religious states. So can you. They are thought-induced states of being, and as they come, so do they go. Krishna consciousness, Buddha consciousness, Christ consciousness, or what have you, are all trips in the wrong direction. They are all within the field of time. The timelessness can never be experienced, can never be grasped, contained, much less given expression to, by any man. That beaten track will lead you nowhere. There is no oasis situated yonder. You are stuck with the mirage. You see, people usually imagine that so-called enlightenment, self-realization, God-realization, or what you will, I don't like to use these words, is something ecstatic, that you will be permanently happy, in a blissful state all the time. These are the images they have of those people. There's no relationship at all between the image you have of that and what actually is the situation. That's why I very often tell people, if I could give you some glimpse of what this is all about, you wouldn't touch this with a barge pole, a 10-foot pole. You would run away from this because this is not what you want. What you want does not exist, you see. If somebody asks me a question suddenly, I try to answer, emphasizing and pointing out that there is no answer to that question. So I merely rephrase, restructure, and throw the same question back at you. It's not game playing, because I'm not interested in winning you over to my point of view. It's not a question of offering opinions. Of course, I do have my opinions on everything from disease to divinity, but they're as worthless as anybody else's. Put it simply, I can't follow a very complex structure. I have that difficulty, you see. Probably I'm a low-grade moron or something. I don't know. I can't follow conceptual thinking. You can put it in very simple words. What exactly is the question? Because the answer is there. I don't have to give the answer. What I usually do is restructure the question, rephrase it in such a way that the question appears senseless to you. Understanding is a state of being where the question isn't there anymore. There is nothing there that says, "Now I understand." That's the basic difficulty between us. By understanding what I am saying, you are not going to get anywhere. It is the questioner that creates the answer, and the questioner comes into being from the answer. Otherwise, there is no questioner. I am not trying to play with words. You know the answer, and you want a confirmation from me, or you want some kind of light to be thrown on your problem, or you're curious. If for any of these reasons you want to carry on a dialogue with me, you're just wasting your time. You'll have to go to a scholar, a pundit, a learned man. They can throw a lot of light on such questions. That's all that I am interested in this kind of dialogue, to help you formulate your own question. Try and formulate a question which you can call your own. Chapter 7. Shadow Dwellers. Illusion recognized must disappear. A Course in Miracles. Two important points are touched upon by U.G. Krishnamurti in the preceding chapter, as shown in the following four excerpts. If somebody asks me a question suddenly, I try to answer, emphasizing and pointing out that there is no answer to that question. So I merely rephrase, restructure, and throw the same question back at you. What exactly is the question? Because the answer is there. I don't have to give the answer. What I usually do is restructure the question, rephrase it in such a way that the question appears senseless to you. Understanding is a state of being where the question isn't there anymore. There's nothing there that says, "Now I understand." It is the questioner that creates the answer, and the questioner comes into being from the answer. Otherwise, there is no questioner. That's all that I'm interested in this kind of a dialogue, to help you formulate your own question. Try and formulate a question which you can call your own. First, the question itself is the obstacle to progress, not lack of an answer. The question is the key. Once we truly understand the question, we'll have the desired answer. The desired answer is always the removal of the obstruction a correct question represents. The question, understood correctly, is the obstruction. If it's not, see the second point. Second, come up with the right question. There's always only one. Wherever you are right now is where you're stuck. And the only question that ever matters is the one that gets you unstuck, that takes you one step further. All other questions are fear-based, ego-sparing time killers. Forget concepts and ideas. Forget past and future. Forget mankind and society. Forget God and love. Forget truth and spirituality. Find that one question, the exact question that ego doesn't want you to ask. Put your full attention on it. That's how progress is made. Everything else is a stall tactic. To move forward, you must figure out exactly what is obstructing you. Whatever it is, it isn't really there. It has no reality, no substance. It's your own creation, a phantom lurking in the shadows of your mind, a shadow demon. Your obstructions are your demons, and your demons are shadow dwellers. They live and thrive in the half-light of ignorance. So the way to slay a demon is by illuminating it with the full force and power of your focused attention, by looking at it hard. Banish shadow with light, and see for yourself that no obstruction exists, nor ever did. We create our demons, and we feed them. To awaken, we must slay them. That's really the whole process. Slay one demon, take one step, repeat. Chapter 8. The Damnedest Thing. Backward I see in my own days where I sweated through fog with linguists and contenders. I have no mockings or arguments. I witness and wait. Walt Whitman. I'm sitting on the deck watching boats in the bay through a pair of rubberized binoculars that are always left outside for this purpose. Thus occupied and thinking myself alone, I am startled to hear Curtis, 3 feet away, delivering a report on my standing in the polls. "You got critics," he says. "I wish," I reply. "You don't got a wish," he says. "Look." "I don't got a look," I say. "I got you." "Well, I looked, and I got this whole mess of stuff saying stuff that's critical about you." He has around 20 emails and amateur reviews printed out. Not bad, considering how many I've asked him to look through. "What kind of critical?" "Some say you're kind of arrogant," he answers. "Okay, that hurts. What else?" "I don't know. You know, critical stuff." I know it looks critical, but it's not. Not really. I wish there was some valid criticism. I don't mean against the core message of damnedest, which is unassailable. If truth be with us, who can be against us, right? But I was hoping for feedback that might expose any gaps in my expression of this subject in Damnedest. We put a lot of effort into making sure Damnedest was complete, that it didn't leave any questions unanswered, that it stood on its own, that nothing else was required. Curtis is giving me the blank look. "You remember it says in Damnedest that there are many questions, but only so many answers?" "Yeah." "Well, we who? Like the Queen, we?" "A bunch of people read through Damnedest before it went to print, looking for problems, gaps, omissions, logical flaws." "Okay." "We wanted to make sure those so many answers were in there. In fact, the original reason behind doing a second book was to reply to what you have in your hand." "Critics." "Right. Kind of. Constructive criticism. We'd hoped that if we missed anything, forgot anything, left anything important out, that it would be brought to our attention by readers, and that reader feedback would provide the basis for a second book, which you're doing. A second book? Yes, but not the one we planned. This one's mostly for fun. Provide some different perspectives. Look at the developmental stages. Describe the view from an uncommon vantage. Specifically, I think it'll focus on the distinction between the two most common goals of spirituality: truth realization, which is enlightenment, and human adulthood, which is a whole different thing, but which is what I think most seekers really want. The second book's not a continuation of the first book. See what I mean? It's not like the next level or anything like that. Damnedest, as it turns out, was complete in itself. It stands alone. We done good. He holds up the printouts. Then what's all this? Look for yourself and see. Look at it like a lawyer or a scientist. Look through the emotion and try to find the substance. See if anyone makes a valid argument, and let me know. Really, that would be very useful to me. Some say you're not enlightened because you talk about me, me, me too much, like you got too much ego. I smile. None of it has anything to do with me. This gets a little tricky. You sure you want to get into it? Yeah. I gesture to an empty chair, and he sits. Well, any time you look at a group of people, any group, really, you can place the individuals on a spectrum of ego attachment. At one end of the spectrum are those who identify completely with their false self, and on the other are those who wear their ego impersonally, like a loose garment. Follow? In the world and of the world at one end, in the world but not of the world at the other. Since this degree of attachment is the only true measure of human age, the spectrum could just as well be represented in years, say 8 to 16. See? Kinda, he says. Not really. Good. Good to say you don't understand when you don't. We'll keep going, and you'll start to see it. The audience for a spiritual book is the same. It can be viewed on a spectrum of ego attachment, which we're saying is like a more accurate way to look at people's age. A book like Damnedest is going to reach a much wider audience than it's really best suited for. It says harsh things, very grown-up things. It says no belief is true. It says gurus and meditation and spiritual teachings are all gentle deceptions meant to soothe the inner coward, not forge the inner hero. So Damnedest looks like a spiritual book, but it's actually an anti-spiritual book. It looks like it's for everyone, but it's really for very few. So when they say you can't be enlightened, me personally, it has nothing to do with me. Anyone who tries to drag me into it is just trying to distract themselves away from the real message, the grown-up message, which is one of self-determination. Very scary stuff. If they say they don't believe I'm enlightened, they're right and they're wrong. They're right because no one is enlightened. I said so in Damnedest. There is no such thing as an enlightened person. It's an immutable contradiction. They're wrong, because when you talk about enlightenment, what I am is what you're talking about, whether you know it or not, whether you like it or not. They're basing their statements on other things. They might feel that enlightenment is a subjective thing, an in-dreams thing, or perhaps they think that I, as an author, am seeking their approval or their verification, that my authenticity is for readers to decide. The spiritual marketplace seems to foster this buyer-seller dynamic rather than the most rigorous scientific-type inquiry, which would be much more appropriate for something so important. Sounds like a popularity contest. Exactly. There seems to be an attitude that opinion counts for something. Goethe said, "None are so hopelessly enslaved as those who falsely believe they're free." I think that applies here. People might say they're spiritual or that they want to know the truth or whatever, but they mostly just want what anyone wants regarding the big questions. Just enough to get by, just enough so they can go on about their lives, maybe make things a little better, puff themselves up a bit. That's about all, really. When it comes to all this religion and spirituality stuff, the closer you look, the foggier it gets. And I think a lot of people are happy just to hang out in the fog. And so these people, he holds up the pages, if they say you don't know what spiritual enlightenment means, that's an interesting question. What does spiritual enlightenment mean? I take it to mean awake, truth realization, abiding, non-dual awareness. But I guess other people take it other ways. There are really only three possible destinations: human adulthood, truth realization, and altered states of consciousness. Truth is absolute. There's nothing more than that. So if someone says enlightenment doesn't mean truth realization, then it's enlightenment they're diminishing, not truth. There's nothing more than truth, and anything less than true is false. So to say that enlightenment means something other than truth realization necessarily means you're saying it's within delusion, which doesn't sound very enlightened. See what I mean? A little. He shakes his head, puzzled. It sounds like people are looking for something, but they don't really know what it is, and they don't really want to find it. I laugh, because that is what it sounds like. That's not crazy? He asks. Crazy is a numbers game. Like, if enough people do it, then it's not crazy anymore. So you write these books, he continues, saying what it really is and how to really find it for people who don't really want it. Well, yeah, maybe. I think some are meant for it, and I think anyone, anywhere on the spectrum, can always use a good map. Whole thing sounds kind of, what? Fucked up. Yeah, I agree. Kind of does. I'm as confused regarding these issues as Curtis. Who wants what? How badly? Why? Who's sincere? Who's just accessorizing? Who's using waking up as a way to go more deeply asleep? Duality is a tangled forest in which many self-styled freedom seekers wield the machete of discrimination with all the effect of a butter knife. Not knowing where, if anywhere, they want to go, they're happy enough where they are. Fearing the genuine, they embrace the counterfeit, opting for words and adornment over authentic change, fueling delusions of spiritual progress with empty practices and useless knowledge, turning in place to create a sense of motion. Most significantly, they inflict no damage on ego, using spirituality to reinforce rather than dismantle self-image. Anyone taking an objective view will conclude, like Goethe, that the less deceived we think ourselves, the more we probably are. Maya's hold over us is strongest when we think it weakest. They say nobody's perfect, and that's a literal fact. If you want to become perfect, become nobody. The only way to get free of Maya's grasp is if there's nothing for her to hold on to. You said in the book you hadn't achieved a better status, right? Asked Curtis. Is that true? Like, right now, you and me have the same status? Sure. We're both sitting here, feeling the sun and the breeze. I'm not up on some mountaintop. You're not plumbing the depths of hell. Do I seem blissed out? Blissed out? Unnaturally happy. You seem like people. That's it. If there's a practical difference, it's that you have more range than I do. You have a lifetime of highs and lows ahead of you. I have a lifetime of contentment. But contentment's a good thing. Not really. Contentment is an other side of the fence thing. Once you have it, you forget what seemed so appealing about it. So it's a bad thing? You see the hammock down there? Yeah? Nice, right? Swaying in a hammock. Gentle breeze. Not a care in the world. Sounds okay, right? Sounds pretty good. It's good in contrast, not as a permanent state. Maybe for half an hour on the occasional Sunday afternoon, not as a living reality. See? Yeah. And that's how you are? I smile. Close. Swinging in a hammock with my hat pulled down and a stupid grin on my face is pretty much my life. Tough thing to complain about. Yes, it is. So, anyway, the difference isn't something I have that you don't. It's something you believe that I don't. You think it's real, and I don't even see it. At this point, I can't even remember it. And what's that? Everything. Everything you believe. Everything you're absolutely certain about. Everything you'd bet your life is true. Curtis knocks on the table. I'd bet my life this table is true. Perfect example, I say. It would never even occur to me that this table might have reality. I have no thought that even resembles that. I have no context in which such a thought could exist. Reality has no reality for me. You're saying there is no table? I'm saying there is no question of a table. He looks at me speculatively for a minute, trying to figure out if I'm really saying that I don't think the table we're both leaning on is real. You're living in the holodeck, he says, referring to the computer-simulated reality environment in Star Trek. Not just the table. Me? The ocean? Everything? I let him think about it. He puts it together quickly. Computer, he says. End program. He looks around expectantly, but nothing changes. Yeah, okay, he says. I guess I got all that from the book. But it sounds like there's a deeper thing, like there's more to it than you said. I'm impressed. Absolutely. Very good. There's the reality, the truth, but Jed McKenna can't express it, and no reader can grasp it. And that's why I said in the book, come see for yourself. That's the only possible response. I know it doesn't make sense. No one who knew what they were talking about ever said it did. It's the paradigm gap. Jed McKenna might do a good job talking about the part that can be talked about, but Jed isn't any more real than this table, and he can really only talk about what's not. Not what is. But something is, right? I mean, like, not nothing? I don't know. Maybe nothing is everything. Like, nothing is something? You got something against nothing? It sounds kind of, I don't know, unsatisfying. I laugh again. Yeah, if you ordered it off the menu, I think you'd have regrets. Well, what does that mean? It means that what we're talking about isn't something someone can desire or wish for. It's not achieved by wanting it, but by hating and destroying its opposite. That's why it's a process of negation. It can look like anger or hatred, but it's more than that. Does that make sense? About as much as any of it. Yeah, well, that's the way of it. Two different paradigms. It doesn't add up in theory the way it does in practice, so the theorists can get a bit crabby. And this is the kind of stuff your audience, the spiritual community, is all about? Not so much. The community, as it were, of spiritually oriented people is pretty diverse. There's no cohesion, no central tenet, no single guiding philosophy that unites them other than being outside the mainstream. There are currents of Buddhist and Hindu thought that run through it, but they don't really form any sort of basis to it at all. There's a lot of metaphysical stuff. I don't know what all. A lot of lifestyle stuff. All sorts of healing modalities. So there's really no single defining quality you can ascribe to the spiritual audience beyond a certain independence of thought, a general rejection of common views on religion, health, lifestyle, well, pretty much everything, I suppose. So these people who write to you, I don't mean it's all bad, it's mostly good, real good. But the bad stuff, like stuff that says I can't be enlightened because I talk from the perspective of an egoic being, well, they don't say it like that. That's the kind of thing that Damnedest addresses as well as it can be addressed. That's one of the answers that's not missing. You've read the book. Could you address that objection based on what you read? He thinks about it. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Right. That's what I mean when I say it's a book for grown-ups. It's not a lazy man's guide to enlightenment, or enlightenment in 30 days, or whatever. Naturally, it gets into the hands of people who have a fairy tale notion of spirituality. And those people are going to react adversely when someone tells them this is a serious business with a nearly perfect failure rate. It's a book for grown-ups. Yeah. People able to face facts, even if it's just enough to see that they don't want to face facts. But not like an age thing. No. True age is different from years since birth. You're older than I was at your age. Really? How old am I this way, the way you're saying? I don't know. A kid? 11? 12? 12? He stiffens. His eyes go wide. I'm 18. I can fight in a war. I hold up my hands. Relax, I say. Take a breath. No need for anger. Release that feeling. He quickly resettles. Okay, now look at that feeling of being insulted. Take a step back and observe yourself, your processes. Look at your reaction to my words. That's what you have in your hand. The people who wrote those notes were having the same reaction you just had. They believe things, and beliefs have emotions in them. People take this stuff personally. It cuts close. It messes with who you are. It's all about discovering that you're not who you think you are. People can get a little feisty. So I'm not really 11 or 12? You were just saying that? I don't know. Let's cut you in half and count the rings. He gives me the blank look again. End of Disc 2.